I appreciate that it actually does take quite a lot of attention and energy to listen for as long as you do. So I thank you for that. But also understandable if sometimes you sink a little bit, and if you find that's happening, you know, you could try the old hands to the heavens approach. So raise a little energy, or as the Buddha suggested, a few pulls on the earlobes. I meant to be good for waking up. I don't know if the Buddha suffered with a lot of sloth and torpor, but you notice how he's often portrayed with these very elongated earlobes, and he's pulling a lot. So what I've been trying to present so far this morning are much more the sort of overriding, or we could even say underpinning, principles of these four qualities of befriending, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And I want to spend just a little bit more time on that, because these are threads that run through all of their development. And then I want to go on to focusing on some of these qualities as cultivations and as insight practices more specifically. So what I'm trying to present is the way in which these Brahmaviharas, these four qualities, the way they hold the whole path of awakening within them. Certainly, clearly, they rest upon ethics and integrity in its deepest sense, a way of being in the world which is not guided so much by self-cherishing or self-protection, but by the cherishing of all living beings. And the Buddha puts this very clearly in the discourse, the teaching on metta. And I always want to paraphrase this because I'm very aware of the cultural connotations of the society that the Buddha lived in. So he says, just as a loving mother would cherish and protect her only child, so too shall we cherish all living beings. So just as a loving father would also protect and cherish his only child, so too shall we cherish all living beings. So within the formal developments of these qualities, the formal cultivation of these qualities, there are several principles. First of all, there is development of what is called in the Buddhist tradition this training of the heart, this training of the mind towards an inner collectedness, an inner poise that is often referred to as samadhi. Okay, that's the word in Pali. It's referred to samadhi. Now, samadhi doesn't refer only to concentration practice, but refers to this initial capacity to collect and to gather our attentiveness and to establish a present moment recollection. I often, recently I have thought of this example. You know, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Wales, but, you know, they have this wonderful breed of Welsh sheepdogs, you know, that go out into these vast fields to gather up the flocks, you know, and they're incredibly skilled. And they go out there and they bring all of these sheep together. They collect them and gather them and guide them to more fertile fields where it's better for them to be, basically. And they don't scare the sheep. They don't bite the sheep, you know. But it's a very intentional gathering and collectedness and bringing our minds to a place where it's better for them to be, where our minds can thrive, not in the domains of fantasy, fragmentation, distractedness, worry, rumination, obsession, protection, preoccupation, but bringing our attention together, collecting and gathering into this present moment awareness, which is actually underpins all meditative development. Clearly underpinning all of these qualities, there is a development of insight, a pervading, transforming, mind-changing, life-changing understanding and learning that we can radically change the shape of our minds from being mired or enmeshed in greed and hatred and delusion and habit into a quality of wakefulness and responsiveness. Responsiveness to life. Responsiveness to whatever is met in the present moment. So clearly this development is so concerned with uprooting the tendencies of greed, of ill will and delusion, and establishing a home where the mind feels like a friend. The mind feels like a friend. The Buddha was once asked, you know, who is your enemy? And he says, your mind is your enemy. And being aware, we use mind and heart interchangeably. He says, who is your enemy? My mind is my enemy. He says, who is your friend? He says, your mind is your friend. Your heart is your friend. And that's the kind of transition we're learning to make. I mean, recently I read something by an American writer, and she says, my mind is like a bad neighborhood, not somewhere where I want to go on my own. You know, so actually we're kind of turning our mind into a good neighborhood, a place where we feel quite safe, a place where we feel quite at ease, a place where we feel this sense of befriending. So there's samadhi, there's insight, there's ethics. Now, again, just to give a little bit of a shift, the way that we've mostly inherited these four qualities, the Brahmaviharas and their practices, it has been primarily in Western practice as a concentration practice. I think it's just important to be clear about this. We have very rarely inherited or been taught these qualities and their development as an insight practice. Constantly repeating a few phrases, very joined up together, without much pause in between them. You know, may I be happy, may I be safe and well, may I be peaceful, may you be happy, may you be... So this kind of constant grounding in the mind, and it has a value, doesn't it, as a concentration practice, because it does collect and it does bring the mind to a focus. And it has a protective element too, because concentration practices always have a protective element. I mean, when we are really focused on something like repeating these phrases over and over again, there's a lot of things we're not doing. You know, we're not lost in rumination. We're not lost in obsession. We're not lost in fantasy. So in a way, there's a very powerful protective element in all concentration practices. Now, and in the traditional way, we've inherited these practices, and many of you are familiar with this, of course, is that we go through the human domains of experience, that the training often is a practice where we begin with ourselves, offering these intentions, these phrases inwardly, moving to a benefactor, a good friend, a neutral person, a difficult person, and all beings. Okay, so this is how these practices are traditionally taught. It's a very systematic practice and development, and I think it is very, very useful for developing, as a skillful means for developing one-pointedness and concentration, and for developing the capacity to sustain attention. However, and this is my however, it is very good to recognize that this came into being about 1,100 years after the Buddha's death. Okay, this is not something you find in the original text. This is a commentarial tradition. It's a commentarial teaching, and I certainly don't mean to be pejorative in any way or judgmental of the commentarial traditions, but it's good for us in our own minds to know the difference between a commentarial tradition and what is held in the early texts. So this primarily came about through a person called Buddhaghosa, some of you will be familiar with. He wrote The Path of Purification about 1,100 years or so after the Buddha's death. And it was an endeavor and an attempt to kind of help to remember the Buddha's teachings through codifying them, you know, through bringing them together in certain lists and certain sections, so that they had a kind of logical, we might say, a more organized approach. And in doing this, what Buddhaghosa did, and I'm not to put down Buddhaghosa because he did an enormous service in doing this, but somehow I think there was a sense of I don't know what to do with the Brahmaviharas, and they got shoved in the concentration section, where they've remained ever since. And this was part of developing this kind of schism between what were Panya traditions or insight traditions and what were concentration traditions. And this is where the Brahmaviharas got shoved and where they've lived ever since. And mostly has informed how we have inherited the teachings on the Brahmaviharas. Now, this is my own feeling, and I'm not purely alone in that, but I don't need bodies to actually defend me. But I feel that slotting the Brahmaviharas solely into a concentration practice does them a grave injustice. It is helpful though to know that it's a lay tradition, and to help to know that many of the kind of current Pali scholars and Dharma scholars, in rereading the early texts, find that this doesn't make a lot of sense, and that it does limit them, and it does create this feeling that we're talking about states or feel good factors that you develop somehow separate from insight. And, it's just a question I would encourage you to entertain in your own mind, whether that makes a lot of sense, or whether there is a way of approaching these pathways which brings all of this together, the development of the heart, the development of these very liberating qualities, ways of uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion, and ways actually of taking the idea of me out of the center of all experience, which is a pretty crucial part. So my basic theme over these 2 days, as you've probably gathered, is to relook at these pathways, and to relook at these pathways as insight practices, as liberating practices, and whether they are or not really entirely relies upon our own approach to them and our own understanding of them. In my own experience, this is the most fruitful way to approach these qualities. In the Dhammapada, one of the most frequently translated early teachings or collection of teachings of the Buddha, there's a verse that says, "The monk, the nun, who dwells in kindness with confidence in the Buddha's teaching, attains the peaceful state, nibbana, the blissful cessation of conditioning." Now, what I want to do over the remaining time we have over this weekend is to reflect on these qualities quite separately and quite individually, to explore each of them in some depth. But as we do this, I would really encourage you, please, not to lose sight of the fact that these are not separate qualities. This is an interactive dynamic. Kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity are all being developed simultaneously, even if we may have a particular focus on one at a time. And there's a wonderful verse, I think, that illustrates this. It was by a teacher of the past called Longchenpa. And he says, "Out of the soil of friendliness grows the beautiful bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy and sheltered under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity." He kind of describes this interactive process of development, I think, which is so helpful too. And there are many texts which are constantly speaking about the ways that these qualities are balancing each other. One text says that metta, or friendliness, brings to equanimity its boundless nature, that compassion guards equanimity from falling into indifference. Equanimity gives selflessness to metta, gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion. That equanimity guards joy from sentimentality and brings all of the noble qualities of the heart together in freedom. So to paraphrase this slightly, that boundless friendliness guards compassion from making hierarchies of suffering, including some and excluding others. It recognizes that all beings are worthy of compassion, that all suffering asks for compassion, no matter how slight or how great. That metta is bringing to equanimity its selfless and its caring quality. It's engaged, so equanimity is engaged. It's not dissociated. That compassion is guarding metta and joy from the forgetfulness of others. So compassion is always bearing in mind the depths of suffering that exist in the world. And compassion is guarding moments of joy and friendliness from turning into states of attachment. And compassion stirs metta and joy to reach out, to reach outwardly, to be boundless. And compassion is encouraging equanimity to be tender and to touch. Joy is guarding compassion from being overwhelmed by suffering and by pain, calming the heart and gladdening the mind and fortifying the heart to meet suffering without fear. Equanimity plays a powerful role, a powerful place. It's deeply rooted in the insight that guards the mind from its tendency, its almost compulsive tendency to fix things or to control all things or to assume an exaggerated responsibility for all imperfection and pain. Equanimity steadies the mind. It brings a home of stability and poise, but it also brings courage to compassion, patience, and steadfastness. So that speaks of having, you get a sense of this sort of interrelated quality and how each of these aspects of the Brahma-Vihara has a purpose in balancing other aspects and protecting some of these domains of inner development from their near enemies, like indifference or sentimentality or being overwhelmed or the compulsiveness to feeling that there must be a solution somewhere. Just take a little moment of pause. Does anybody have any questions about that? Yes, please. And the compulsion to fix all things. The question was, would I elaborate on my last sentence, which is about this compulsion to always be fixing everything? And that there has to be a solution. Okay. I mean, I think I will go into this more, if you don't mind, when I reflect on compassion more specifically this afternoon. But being aware that fixing things and finding solutions is not coming out of bad intentions or unwholesome intentions, that it often comes out of the feeling of helplessness we experience in the face of the difficult and suffering. You know, we're can-do kind of culture, you know. So, you know, we get out our toolbox, and often we move I will talk about this more this afternoon, but these two dimensions of compassion, which are empathy and responsiveness, you know, turning outwardly to act. But I think very often we are a little bit prone to skip the empathy part and move into the action part too quickly. And in that, you know, I mean, of course, there is pain in the world that can be fixed. You know, if you're ill, you go to a doctor, and there may indeed be a solution. And then there's the question, as Nagarjuna put it, he says, what do you do with the life that doesn't go away? You know, what do you do with the chronic illness that doesn't go away? You know, the broken relationship that doesn't have a solution, the losses that can't be recovered. You know, what do we do with the life that cannot be fixed? That's this afternoon's. Reflection. But we've got started. Mm-hmm. I've got started. So let us take the first of the Brahmaviharas, the word metta. So let's just look a little bit at the roots of metta. First of all, just to mention that this quality of boundless, unshakable, immeasurable kindness or friendliness is the only one of these qualities that has its own dedicated discourse in the early texts. So clearly, and it's found in a collection of teachings called the Sutta Napata, some of you may be familiar with, which are very widely acknowledged as being pretty much some of the earliest teachings of the Buddha. It's not a set of discourses that has a lot of popularity in translation, because it's kind of, parts of it are kind of awkward to understand. But metta is the only one that has its own dedicated discourse, which I think is some signifier of how much the Buddha valued kindness and friendliness as being the foundation of all of the other qualities. This is our starting point. So I wanted to read to you, if I can recover it here somewhere. It's a newer translation of the Metta Sutta. It has some differences from the ones that we're more familiar with. I want to read this to you because I want to spend a bit of time with this. To reach peace, one skilled in the good should be capable and upright, straightforward and easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters. In our language, we might say that, without greed for approval. And should not do the least thing that the wise would later criticize. We could reflect, may all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be peaceful-minded. All beings, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, small or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be peaceful-minded. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere. Let no one, through anger or hatred, wish for others to suffer. As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so for all beings one should guard one's boundless heart. With friendliness for the whole world should one cultivate a boundless heart above, below, and all around, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, whenever one is awake, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the most noble way of living in this world, here and now. One who is virtuous, endowed with insight, not grasping after wrong view, and having overcome all greed, will not come to lie in a womb again. So it's important to, I think, reflect on, we could spend a lot of time unpacking this discourse, but just to notice what is mentioned, integrity, insight, the uprooting of ill will, the boundless nature of metta. So what is important to, I think, first of all, remember is in the early texts, metta is not a word that stands alone. It is always metta bhavana. Okay, and remember the word I was referring to, the cultivation of metta. The cultivation of boundless friendliness. So it is always metta bhavana, bringing metta into being, this attitude of befriending, building upon something. So the etymology, the kind of roots of this word in Pali, metta, really translates as to befriend. It has its roots in the word maitri, which is to be a friend to befriend. Okay, this has its roots in an earlier word in Sanskrit, I think it's ka, which actually means to grow fat with kindness, which is rather a lovely kind of phrase, to grow fat with kindness. Now, as a fruition, of course, metta is translated as boundless, immeasurable, unshakable friendliness and kindness. Now, I know, and again, I don't want to sound at all judgmental. I mean, I know the most familiar translation of metta is as loving kindness. It's not a problem for some, it's a problem for many. There can be the implication that we have to love everything, which makes the cultivation of metta very, very difficult for many people. If I work with someone and they're in the midst of an abusive relationship, I could not encourage people to love this or like this. If I'm working with someone who's living with a chronic illness or a life-threatening illness, I could not ask people to love this or even like this. If I'm working with someone who's even, you know, really struggling just with some minor pain or, you know, nagging affliction, I cannot ask them to love it. In most, this is a bit of a sidebar, but I'll throw it in anyway. In most recent research in the kind of mindfulness-based application world, the reason why metta practice is excluded from this development is because research trials show that for someone living with chronic depression, metta practice, as we have inherited, is a trigger for depressive relapse. In the way that we have inherited it, and I really want to stress that. Because of this implication, first of all, you know, first of all, a person might think, I don't have any benefactors, I don't have any friends, you know. I only have difficult people, and also the implication that perhaps I need to love this very painful state. But I'm saying because we have inherited it in a particular way with a particular language in, and this is, of course, not only an exclusion that is felt with people who have a history of depressive relapse. I have met many people who would consider themselves reasonably well who feel themselves to be exiled from metta practice because they think they're supposed to feel something. They're supposed to feel some love towards all of these things. Now, in the, you know, so I just want to put that in as a sidebar. It's not at all in any way meant to be a criticism of many of the translations of metta practice, which, again, many people have found to be extraordinarily useful and helpful. but I just want to consider this practice, even if it invites controversy or invites, you know, a backlash. I want to consider this in a slightly wider way, and that you metta practice does not imply that you have to love something or even like something. Again, I think this is going too much in this domain of what we feel rather than how we are. What kind of state is present rather than how we are relating. So I want to refer back to something that I mentioned this morning, that Pali is a language of process. And metta is a process of befriending, of cultivating our capacity to meet all things with a behavioral gesture of the mind, which is to incline towards the willingness to meet, the willingness to stand near to. The word love in our culture, I think, has a lot of emotional baggage and complexity to it. The capacity to befriend may be something we can consider, even in the most difficult and dire conditions and circumstances. We may be able to befriend this. We may be able to stand near to this. So metta begins, of course, and I think I've always mentioned this, this behavioral inclining of the mind with an attitude of tenderness, an attitude of care to meet the moment, is really going hand in hand with sati. It's really going hand in hand with mindfulness. As the Buddha put it, to resolve upon this mindfulness, resolve upon it, to resolve upon this way of being in our lives. Whether during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart, this way of being, and this way of living that is best in this world. May we resolve upon it. This is asking a lot. This is asking for a huge level of commitment and dedication. And it surely is, isn't it, swimming against the tide. It surely is swimming against the tide. So with the mindfulness, and I want to interweave mindfulness and metta, because there's simply no way that I can, in my own understanding, separate these two. I think metta without mindfulness is probably not metta at all, and I think mindfulness or sati without this attitude of befriending is probably not mindfulness at all. So these two need to be, I think, interwoven in every aspect of our path. So the aspect of mindfulness is that it's an antidote to heedlessness. You know, sometimes sati is translated as remembering. Not only remembering this present moment recollection, but this much broader spectrum of remembering what we value, what we hold dear to us, what we hold to be worthy, what we aspire to, the path that we've set ourselves upon, this quality of remembering all of this. So sati, our mindfulness, this quality of remembering, is very clearly an antidote to heedlessness and to forgetfulness, including forgetting the very pivotal and central quality of metta in our lives. So we're remembering metta. We're remembering how to be present. Now, this is, again, I'm going to have a lot of sidebars here. But, you know, we need to recognize this tension in our lives, isn't it? This tension of waking up. And, you know, the Buddha emphasizes this tension all the time. You know, we have aspirations, we have intentions, and we have habits, psychological and emotional habits, of aversion, of reactivity, of ill will, of anxiety. So these two are sitting alongside most of us in our lives. Do you recognize that? You know, I mean, how many times we get up in the morning, you know, most of us have the intention to go out in our day with a reasonable amount of, you know, sensitivity and care and attentiveness until the traffic jam or the difficult person or, you know, the overload at work or the reactivity of another person. And then we just see ourselves moving between these two all the time, you know, aspiration, intention, and habit. This is the tension of this path. Now, of course, as Westerners, we're very prone to, this sidebar is going on, we're very prone to meet that tension with judgment, with self-blame. You know, oh, I really blew it again. You know, I'll never be able to do this. Other people can do this. I'll never do this. You know, look how useless I am as a meditator. You know, I'm clearly not cut out for this. You know, I need to choose a different career path as a golfer or something. You know, as meditation stuff is not something I'm capable of. So we usually meet this tension with judgment. The fourth way of establishing mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta speaks directly to this tension. Here we have the world of habit. Here we have the world of aspiration and cultivation. This is not a negative tension. This is a dynamic tension. This is a creative tension. This is our curriculum. This is where we practice. There is no curriculum outside of this curriculum. Because this is what's going on in our minds moment to moment. This is what's going on in our lives moment to moment. And the Buddha describes this is where he so firmly rooted this practice in the classroom of our lives, not somewhere else, not in some disembodied state. This is where we learn to cultivate metta, joy, compassion, equanimity, not somewhere else. So we look at what are the things that help us to remember, and we look at what is it that makes us forgetful. What is it that makes us forgetful? This is a very important investigation. And in some ways it's quite personal, and in some ways it's quite universal. You know, and from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, what makes us forgetful are the hindrance factors. The craving for sensual pleasure, the aversion, the restlessness and worry, the dullness and sleepiness, and the doubt. Now, these manifest in countless different ways in our life. You know, the craving for sensual pleasure accounts for much of our distractedness, you know, our need to go into more fantasy and lean forward into a better moment. Aversion accounts for much of our judgmental, fearful mind and action. Restlessness and worry accounts for a lot of our rehearsing, trying to control, trying to fix everything. You know, sleepiness and dullness accounts for many of our moments of dissociation, where we just check out. And doubt accounts for with what happens when everything, all of the other above hindrance factors don't work. As a solution. And when we kind of despair and say, you know, this is really impossible. But it's really important, you know, and many of you have practiced, are very, very familiar with these hindrance factors, and you kind of hear about them and eyes glaze over, you know, and we say, oh, that again, you know. But actually, the Buddha said, you know, this is much of our practice. This is much of our cultivation. And actually, to give even a different perspective on it, the Buddha speaks about the five hindrance factors as being the five manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. This is how they manifest. And that greed, hatred, and delusion are the three manifestations of what is called avidya, or confusion, or ignorance. So we've got a continuum here. You know, and basically, as the continuum, what we really encounter are the hindrance factors. So these are the forgetfulness factors, you know, and you can put a lot of our broken relationships and dysfunctional lives and bad neighborhoods of our minds down to these forgetfulness factors. You know, and in fact, it's impossible to find a single psychological emotional storm where these five forgetfulness factors have not flared up and are really central to those psychological storms. So these are the forgetfulness factors. So actually what we're doing is introducing remembering factors into the forgetfulness factors. We're learning to introduce remembering factors into those forgetfulness factors. The emphasis upon intention, clarifying our intentions, the emphasis upon remembering our aspirations, our motivations, the emphasis upon sati, of mindfulness, the emphasis upon training the mind, the heart. The Buddha once said, I can think of no one thing that does so much harm as an untrained heart. And that once understood, I can think of no one thing that is a greater friend than a well-trained heart. And training may sound a bit boot campish, but it's not meant to be that way. It is remembering to incline towards, and that what we frequently think about, dwell upon, and incline towards, this will become the shape of our mind. So looking again just at this interface between sati, our mindfulness, and metta, if you think about it, the nature of sati, or the nature of mindfulness, is to turn towards all things, isn't it? We turn towards the body, we turn towards sound, we turn towards the mind, we turn towards the moment. This is actually the nature of sati, is to turn towards all things. And that turning towards all things has the effect of illuminating what we turn towards. It's almost, it awakens it, it almost brings it to life. You know, if you think of the example of this when you go out in a walking path, you know, if you're lost in the forgetfulness factors, you know, you could go through a whole walking period, the bell rings, and you come back and you realize you haven't seen or listened to or felt a single thing. You know, it's been a period of amnesia almost. If you go out into that same walking path with that intention and inclination to turn towards, what happens? You suddenly see, you listen, you are touched by. And this applies not only to the external world, but of course it applies to our internal world. We are turning towards the life of our body, the life of our minds, and they are illuminated. So this is the kind of inclination of metta, of sati, I would say, is to turn towards what is being experienced in this present moment. And then the nature of metta is developing the capacity to stand near to or to stand next to what has been turned towards. So this is not a neutral turning towards. It's not turning the kind of cold glare of attention upon our experience. But it is turning towards, standing near to. Think of how that translates in your mind. Because it's not when we turn towards all things, it's automatically lovely and terrific, is it? You know, sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's hard to be with. And metta is developing this attitudinal foundation of sati, which is the willingness to befriend, to stand next to that which has been towards. So the practice, I might mention that the Buddha in one place refers to metta as being the highest mindfulness, the highest sati. So the practice of metta, as we've inherited, and it's a very useful practice, it uses a few simple phrases to cultivate intention and to serve as a focal point of collectedness. So there's two things are held in those phrases. So the phrases that are used in formal metta practice, may you be happy, may I be peaceful, these are not just empty words, okay? First of all, they are ways of articulating a certain intention or inclination. The mind is directed towards. But they're also serving as the place that we collect and gather our attention around. We're using learning to keep the mind steady. There's a word in Pali that describes the mind that doesn't float away. We're using it to learn to keep the mind steady. So they're not empty recitations. These are not affirmations. They're not mantras. But they're articulations of intention, aspiration, and inclining the mind towards befriending. Now, as a concentration practice, if we were to use this as a concentration practice, which it can be done, has a purpose, our attention would be primarily focused upon keeping the phrases going, you know, very linked up, very joined up. As an insight practice, we would use the phrases differently. A little bit like dropping a stone into a well and allowing a lot of space and a lot of pause and seeing what response arises. May I be peaceful. Then I listen inwardly. I'm not saying I am peaceful. I'm not saying I should be peaceful. This is an invitational quality. It's a suggestion of a possibility, of a potentiality in this moment, in the midst of all things. May I be peaceful? Then I listen inwardly. What does that mean for me? How does that land? What is my response to that? May I be safe and protected? I pause. I listen inwardly. I'm aware of whatever narrative gets triggered. I'm aware of whatever response gets triggered. What I understand by those words, and the words, of course, are not reified, there's nothing particularly sacred about any of these words. May I live with ease and with kindness? And I stop and I pause and I listen. What does that mean for me? What does it remind me of? What does it help me to remember? So as an insight practice, we're starting to slow this whole thing down. We're starting to look at how intention actually rubs up against habit. You know, I offer that phrase inwardly. May I be peaceful? Oh, except, you know, or but, or maybe, you know. May you be peaceful. You'd be a much better person if you were peaceful. You know, my life would be a lot easier if you were peaceful, really. You know, we start to listen. How is that landing? You know, what is the rub with our habit patterns and our tendencies and our first layer of response? So as an insight practice, we're actually using the phrases as anchor as much as we might use, say, the breath as an anchor in a different style of practice. It serves as a place we can bring our attention back to when we get lost in the narrative or when we get lost in the habits. But we have this receptive attention, this kind of quality of listening inwardly, like dropping pebbles into a still pond. Many responses do arise. You know, sometimes we're bored. Sometimes we're disinterested. Sometimes we hate the phrases. Sometimes we wonder when this wonderful feeling of tenderness is going to arrive. You know, sometimes we just space out. And we recognize that these are actually manifestations of the hindrance factors, aren't they? That arise in a lot of areas of our life. These are not unfamiliar reactions. They can be a very familiar scale of emotional response. It's not like we're so surprised, or we shouldn't be so surprised, actually. But then we ask, do these reactions actually prohibit metta? Or are these reactions that arise as we begin to almost play our emotional scale Are these reactions themselves then the places that are inviting metta? How do you stand near to aversion? How do you stand close to disinterest? How do you befriend doubt? What does it mean to embrace those experiences with that gesture of care and that gesture of tenderness and that gesture of kindness? They become the objects of metta. Now, what is happening is that the very sustained dedication to staying close to the phrases is a dedication, sustained dedication, to staying close to this attitude of care and befriending. They're not separate. So the phrases become almost a way that we stay close to that intentionality. And we're being undissuaded. This is a big piece. We're being undissuaded by the reactions. We're being undissuaded by the habits. You know, we're being undissuaded by the disinterest, the aversion, the judgment, the doubt. We're learning actually what it means to be undissuaded by selfing. We're learning what it means to be undissuaded by selfing, because the hindrances is where self-construct is built. It's where self-construct is built. Okay, so we're learning to be undissuaded by that, and we're actually cultivating a mind that is being inclined towards freedom rather than the mind that creates and recreates distress. And so that's the inclination. And this might be a good moment for a pause. Anybody have any question? Yes, please.
Since you brought up self, that's always been a question I have about metta, is the idea of sending it to others, and yet we're attempting to disassemble the I and other beings, that there's a separateness. So that's something I've wondered about.
So the question is that this kind of question about we're sending metta to others, and yet who is sending it? Oh, it's a very good question. I have never sent metta to anybody in my entire life. I don't actually believe it's possible. It's a bit akin to saying I should let go. How successful have you been in that, I might ask? You know, usually spectacularly unsuccessful, the idea that I should let go. You know, it's a kind of a strange concept, isn't it, that we spend so much time in this teaching contemplating non-self, that there is no independent, autonomous me at the center of all experience. And then somehow we imagine that I've got one that can send metta. And I've got one that can let go. I'm very glad you raised that question, because I don't think we do send metta. I think what we do is actually we cultivate a certain attitudinal space within our minds, and we invite different aspects of relationship to sit in that space and see how we can respond to them. Does that make more sense? Does that make some sense to you? Okay, so I'm not sending metta. If I visualize a benefactor or a difficult person, you know, I'm not really sending the metta. I'm cultivating a mind that is established in an attitude of befriending and tenderness and care. And I invite that person who represents all the benefactors in my life, and I will get into this more this afternoon, to sit in that space and to be included in that space. It is about changing our relationship to things. And it's not about centralizing me. And which is why, as an insight practice, you know, metta has to have something to do with understanding non-self. And there's many layers of that. You know, it's both kind of turning down the volume of selfing, which is very high in aversion and ill will, you might notice. turning down the tendency of selfing to create the other. And, you know, certainly the skillful means of using the different human domains of this practice, but actually seeing that it's meant also to allow those different domains to fall away, you know, and that there is an unshakable befriending no matter where what is being met. So it's not about solidifying or reifying the other, whether it's a positive other in terms of good friends and benefactors, or whether it's a negative other in terms of difficult people. So there's some depth to this practice. You know, it's not just about throwing a few phrases around here and there. There is some depth to this practice, understanding, you know, what actually creates ill will. What does it rest upon? What does hatred and aversion actually rest upon? And it rests upon this selfing and othering simultaneously arising in a climate of ill will or fear. And what actually we are cultivating within this thread of practice is a climate of befriending, of care, of tenderness, in which the selfing and the othering can fall away. Yes, please. That's coming. Okay, so the question is about cultivating metta and compassion with people that are difficult or that you dislike. It's coming soon to this screen.
I get told a lot, don't rent space in your head, but that seems to be what we're doing.
Well, I'm not quite. The question is, she gets told a lot, don't rent space in your head. Metta is about inhabiting all things. It's not about being identified. It's not about being governed by. There is always a liberative element within metta practice. But it has no exclusions. It has no exclusions, including the, you know, if it wasn't for difficulty in this life, there would be no need for metta. So we'll look at that a little bit later on this afternoon about what the sense of the other really rests upon and how much the sense of the other actually really often rests upon craving and ill will, where we posit, not only do we posit an independent self inwardly, sorry, I'm getting into what I'm going to talk about, so we posit an independent sense of self outwardly. You have the power to make me angry. That's positing an independent self outwardly. Okay, but we'll get into that with a little bit more detail this afternoon, if we have time. Yes, please.
I'm just wondering if you're going to speak more about dissociation and being able to recognize when you're in a dissociated state and how to come back to
the... Well, I mean, the question is how we recognize dissociation and how we can remember to come out of it. I mean, that this is a problem, you know, and it's part of this whole spectrum of sleepiness and dullness, you know. When we hear sleepiness and dullness, we imagine about nodding off, but it's something far more profound than that. It's a quality of numbness and removal and disconnection and dissociation. And, you know, it's the primary mechanism that we often use to... When pushing away doesn't work, we check out. We check out. So, you know, it's often following on the footsteps of aversion or fear. Now, you know, I mean, to look at it a little bit more fully, you know, for example, people with abuse histories dissociation has often been a survival mechanism. You know, it's how they've protected themselves and kept themselves in some way sane. In our present day, dissociation is the way that we keep ourselves a little bit removed and defended often against life. And it's a complex state because it often has within it the fear of incapacity, the fear of being overwhelmed. It can also just have disinterest within it and boredom. But it's this numbing out space, you know, this desensitized almost space. And with anything within our repertoire of emotions and mental states, you know, the very first step is always becoming intimate with the landscape of our own minds, you know, our own hearts. And actually starting, you know, because some people, most people experience all of the forgetfulness factors in one form or another, and because they are interrelated. But many people specialize. And it's good to recognize our specialties. You know, so it's not as if our most difficult forgetfulness factors are so unfamiliar to us. We just don't want to know them often. That can be part of that. We don't want to know them. Or they can be so familiar to us that they've been built in to be the structure of our view of self. I'm just an angry person. You know, I'm just an agitated person. It's just something we've repeated really a lot of times. And it's now become. So, you know, part of the invitation, and I think part of the compelling force behind mindfulness is actually wanting to know. We come out of this place of not wanting to know what's going on. We want to know. And then that's the first step towards some kind of intimacy, of knowing where we specialize, knowing our emotional repertoire, knowing our habit patterns. How do I get to sense it? Where does it start? You know, I start to sense the moments, prayer, for example, where numbness or dissociation is not present. You know, I once spoke to someone who worked as a masseur in India with people who were quadriplegic, and she said that what she would start was the one tiny spot in the body that was alive. And by massaging that, expanding that, sometimes we need to know the places where this is not present. And then we start to see where we move from aliveness into disconnection or aliveness into dissociation. But it's just exploring this map, you know, with this tenderness of touch, with this quality of metta, that this is not something wrong, terrible, imperfect, failure. Is this something that I have a gesture, an inclination of befriending, of being kind towards? But it is an investigation. It is an investigation.